So welcome, everyone. Glad to have you all here this evening. Very much looking forward to the program. We've got four extremely interesting, three speakers. I wouldn't call you a formal speaker tonight. I know you're going to say a few things tonight, Aaron, as you usually do, but some really interesting presentations to listen tonight. So I'm very much looking forward to getting all the insights and the detail. But on behalf of the Australian Serbian Chamber of Commerce, welcome to the Australia-Serbia Trade Services Forum. I'm not going to talk for too long, but I just thought it was important to sort of set the scene and introduce the Chamber and talk a little bit about tonight's topic and sort of why we're here and what we're looking to do. So just a little bit about the Chamber itself. So we've been around for 2 years. It'll be 2 years in November since we formed, and during that time we've achieved quite a number of things. And with support of both governments, Serbian government, the Australian government, we've managed to set ourselves up hopefully for the future and set the Chamber up as a viable organisation. So far we've admitted in excess of 35 members, and each member, I think, is unique. They have different objectives in terms of what they want to achieve, whether it's networking, whether it's, pushing through their, trade objectives or meeting the next person who will be their business partner. So, as is usually the case, these events, you sort of never know who you're going to meet. It's one of those things. In terms of the Chamber itself, the other thing I wanted to point out, we work very closely with the ICH, so very glad to be able to be hosted here tonight. Margaret, thank you for your hospitality. And we're also members of the EABC, which is the European Australian Business Council, which is a pan-European Chamber of Commerce based in Sydney. So with that said, just wanted to say a few things about our objectives. So, as I said, furthering of the bilateral trade is probably one of the key objectives, networking as well. And those are some of the things that we're going to explore tonight. So, trade services came about a number of months ago. Our key pillars are spread across services, trade, mining, and tourism. So, services trade is a discipline that a number of our members are engaged in, and we felt it was the right forum to engage. Recently, I was fortunate to be present in Belgrade at the business breakfast briefing organised by the Ambassador Ruth Stewart, and during that briefing, services came up very prominently as an area of future growth. And when I say services, it could be a number of things. It could be IT, it could be education, it could be architectural, engineering, or other type of services. So, and we're very much looking for a two-way engagement, although we recognise there are some limitations with the countries in the region in terms of what they've got to offer back to Australia. So I think a very, very well-deserved topic tonight. In terms of setting the scene a little bit further, Serbia, I think some people here in the room will be familiar where Serbia is, some perhaps not, I don't know, I don't want to take any chances, but so Serbia is a southeastern European country of 7 million people. It borders four EU countries, being Croatia, Romania, if I get all these right, Hungary and Bulgaria. It also borders a couple of other countries that are looking to join the EU, such as Bosnia, Macedonia, Montenegro, etc. So that said, Serbia is a landlocked country, but it sits on a major European waterway, being the Danube. So even though we don't have access to the sea, there is quite a lot of trade moving through that major European waterway. In terms of the relationship between Australia and Serbia, I just wanted to set some context of what that looks like. I had a look at some stats, and I think I prefer the number in your presentation, Ben, which interestingly differs from the DFAT number. But the services trade are roughly about $140 million both ways. And overall merchandise trade is roughly about $55 million. So not a lot. They're quite small numbers, but plenty of opportunity to grow going forward. The other interesting fact that I came across is that Serbia has a preferential goods treatment, which was facilitated by the customs amendment to the Customs Tariff Act 2012. I don't know if I got that right, probably not, but there was an amendment in 2012 which facilitates that. And as far as the future relationship, a lot of questions that we get asked, and I think Chu Yang approached me earlier on and said, where is Serbia on the EU path? And I just wanted to cover off a few interesting stats. So there's a number of countries that are yet to join out of that region, which is sort of more broadly defined as the Western Balkans. And Serbia is in that pack. More recently, there have been announcements by the EU Commission which foresee that that enlargement will happen somewhere around the 2025. So what that means between now and then is that there's a whole lot of different regulations that need to be adhered to and accomplished by those respective countries, and Serbia is one of them. Serbia has been earmarked as the front runner to join, notwithstanding the fact that they need to obviously comply with a number of different regulations and closing of the remaining chapters. I think statistically, roughly about half of the chapters, accessory chapters, have been open. So there's about 35, I think, and roughly about 14 have been open so far. So that's the path. So what does that mean? That means that they're not in EU just as yet, but it also means they're part of the SEFTA arrangements. The SEFTA arrangement provides for free trade. SEFTA has abolished tariffs between countries a long time ago, and all the countries that are part of SEFTA and that have joined the EU, basically that agreement ceases. The countries that are still waiting to join EU, the SEFTA, I think, still applies. So that's the framework. In terms of the statistics, I've just pinched a few things today. FDI 2017, I'm not sure whether these figures will mean a lot to a lot of people here, but I thought it was interesting, $2.6 billion and one of the front runners as far as FDI is concerned. Unemployment, not a great stat, 12%. Just sort of point out some of the bad stuff as well. And this year's growth, it's sitting at around 4.8, which is a huge acceleration from where it was a couple of years ago. So they're probably the most interesting stats that I thought I would share with you. On the other hand, I think Australia probably needs no introduction. Developed economy, part of G20, and has so much to offer in terms of either welcoming investors or exporting capital as well. So, and I'm sure we'll hear a few more things from Ben and Chu Yang in terms of what Austrade is doing in that space, and also some of the barriers to entry, free trade agreements and the like, which set up the framework for trade between the countries. So with that said, I'll probably leave it to our expert panel speakers to deliver their presentations, and what we're looking to do today is have those presentations and then have an expert panel speaker moderate the session, which is Aaron. And before I say that, I'll let Aaron say a few words as well. And Aaron is the president of the Central Eastern European Forum and has been great introducing us to CEE Forum and obviously supporting us with some events in the past. And thank you for having me here tonight.
Pleasure. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And it was about a year ago when we started a conversation with Sasha and Goran. And just to clarify, I'm unfortunately no president. I'm just one of the organizers of an annual event series called the Central European Business Forum. And we've been doing that for some time with the vision that we would like to bring Central and Eastern and including Southeastern European markets closer to Australian business people to consider opportunities in terms of engaging export, import and investment. And so we wanted this to allow us to bridge a gap that was there in terms of the understanding of these markets and anticipating their potential, in particular by local business people. So I thought that in order to progress that mission, I was very pleased when I was invited to help the Australian-Serbian Chamber of Commerce team to contribute and organize this event. And that I'm very fortunate. I think Sasha has made a great speech, so I don't need to cite all the data again. But I'd like to point out a few key things where I think this event has something unique to deliver with regards to services trade possibilities between Australia and Serbia. So first of all, I would like to say that Serbia is part of what an Ernst & Young report about 6 or 7 years ago already identified as emerging Europe. And these are the economies in Europe, either in the European Union or outside, but their neighbors, which are displaying substantial economic growth rates. So I'm not sure what, if I recall correctly, 4.8%?
Yeah, that's the change in the last 12 months for this quarter.
Which is not bad. Not bad for what we would consider an otherwise developed economy. I would say that building on this, that region of Europe is actually presenting an unexplored potential, both in terms of market growth and other complementarities to Australian businesses. And the areas in which I see there are opportunities in services trade include tourism, education, business services, and professional services. And the region has a lot of unique things to offer. And as Serbia being a member of or part of that region, these things also hold true for Serbia. That includes educated workforce, educated and unexploited workforce. And I'm sure that you're familiar with the situation in the sense that if you come from a small country in Europe, you might as well, you better learn a couple of foreign languages. It doesn't work any other way. And so what you'll find is that within that population, especially in the younger generation, a lot of people speak English, Spanish, German, Italian, name it. There's a lot of foreign language talent, which allows a better engagement and provides a possibility of these countries acting as a gateway to accessing other markets in the European Union or in Europe with higher disposable incomes, providing sort of a gateway function. I think that's very important to note. And there are two great things that are happening at the moment. And one, I think Sasha mentioned both of them, that will change shape the future of these opportunities. One of them is the European Union accession of Serbia. And that process seems to have sufficient political support and is going forward. And the other one is the European Union-Australia Free Trade Agreement, which also seems to have sufficient political support and is going forward. And once these things two things fall into place, the opportunities will probably multiply and open up to a far greater extent that they are visible today. So being here and being proactive, I'd like to congratulate all of you. And I'd like to pass it on to our panel speakers to share their ideas. So, thank you.
Mine.
Yeah, you're first.
Oh, I need to grab my notes.
Let's start from the beginning.
Thanks again for having me here, Sasha, and once again, good evening, everyone. I just have to learn how to use this.
Easy.
Here, did I get it upside down?
Yeah. Okay, it's working.
Okay, yeah.
Super.
All right, so thank you.
Pleasure.
This is a massive one. It's too big for this room. Keep frightening. I seldom use notes, but what happened was last Friday, our trade minister, Simon, just delivered a speech in Sydney in regards to Australians' investment. And it was very related to what I would like to discuss today. So I really regretted he didn't deliver the speech earlier. Otherwise, I can reflect them in my presentation. So I have to put a few notes. That's why I have my notes here. My name is Chu Yang. I work with Austrade. So the full name is Australian Trade and Investment Commission. So we are federal government's trade and investment agency by name. So we do actually four things. We attract foreign investment into Australia, and we promote Australian trade into foreign countries, and we do two-way education, and we do two-way tourism. So two things. So I wear two hats. I'm the Deputy State Director in Victoria, and also I look after Austrade's onshore all the work related with China. As you could imagine, that's a lot of work. So up to 2 years ago, I was trade commissioner based in Australian Embassy in Beijing. And coincidentally, I was in charge of Australian-China services. So we, each trade commissioner look after one industry sector. My colleagues either look after mining, infrastructure, agri, education. So I was a commissioner for services. So what we discuss today would be extremely relevant. Although Serbia is a relatively a small economy, I think as far as service is concerned, the potential will be huge. I'm not saying this to make you feel good. It is just because when people naturally get wealthier and their living standard increase, same as a lot of Asian countries that I look after, and you naturally need a better education, a better, more decent living standard. You want to send your kids to better school and how to manage my money, my super. So that's all services. Especially Australian is very strong in innovation. So I really look forward to chatting with you. My presentation, typical government presentation, could be quite high level boring. I try to make it as less boring as possible. So the three things I cover very quickly, I'd like to spend some time in question time, because two-way talk, I may not have the answer, but we talk about something we're both interested in, so that's more valuable than one-way lecturer. So I want to talk three things, mainly about why Australia is a good destination for investment, and also the FIRB, the Foreign Investment Review Board, how it works, and of course how Australia can help. So just very briefly, figures, they're very self-explanatory there. So Australian in the OECD countries doing pretty well. So this is a figure, 2017, 27 years non-stop consecutive growth, which is really great, especially when you consider the global financial crisis and a few other up and downs. And as a small economy, Australians only 24, 25 million people, and you think it is the fifth largest economy in this region and number 13 in the world, so we're doing very, very good indeed. And there's all sorts of connections. I almost every day go to a workshop with different regions, but with this part of the world, I must say this is the first time, and I hope we got more connection. It is really critical for Australian as well. So this table is the main, we're talking about the FDI, so the foreign direct investment into Australia. So not surprisingly, United States is number one. So last year was about 190 billion US dollars for FDI into Australia. And there's a couple of other European countries on the table. I did a calculation. When you add them together, they actually equivalent to the U.S. figure. So I'm saying the European Union, not the European Union, the European region as a region is a very, very vital area. So they're small countries, but you add them together. Just before I came over, I went to DFAT website to have a look. So if you follow different source of information, this table might be a bit different. So like in the DFAT table last year, so US number one, UK number two. So they're slightly different, but more or less that's just an indicative figure. There's a number of countries on the table, like Bermuda or a few others. I have not worked out what direct FDI they come into Australia. So if any of you know what kind of merchandise, let me know. I want to learn. I know these areas are quite tax haven. So my previous life was a maritime lawyer. So what was the goal there for the flag of convenience? So that's understandable. But why they're coming in is so critical, I don't know, and I want to learn. So let's talk about that later during the networking time. So once again, we are emphasizing Australian as a very important. Okay. So the importance of foreign investment into Australia. I have a few figures here from Minister's speech last Friday. So investment, foreign investment support, 1 in 4 jobs here in mining field, mining sectors, 1 out of 5 in information media and telecommunication, 1 out of 6 in manufacturing areas, and 1 out of 8 out of professional, scientific, and technology services. So investment is doing a very important contribution to sustaining Australia's economy. So before I move to the next subject, which is on the foreign investment regulation, I would like to just verbally, this is not in my presentation, talk a little bit about the free trade agreement that Australia engage in. So this could be inflow or outflow, but Australia is doing very, very good in setting up either multilateral, regional, or bilateral trade, free trade agreement with key economies. So even with WTO, a lot of you know WTO, there's a lot of controversies about its future, its role. Australia is leading in doing its dispute settlement, its trade facilitation agreement. So all those are the key supporter in a rule-based economy. So as long as you want to be transparent, rule-based, those are regardless what happened in WTO. I worked 4 years in WTO in Geneva, 2000 to 2004. So after Doha round, there's a lot of changes, but Australia is a forerunner in this kind of agreement. And the other thing Sasha mentioned just now about Australia's free trade agreement with European Union. So this was started in June this year. It is very recent. And the whole package, we're talking about 500 million population in European Union. And when Serbia become fully part of a member in this massive bloc, there will be a lot of two-way, not only tariff reductions. Tariff is already very low. So the main advantage will be the non-tariff on service. So how to lower the market access threshold, so mutual recognition of certificates or that rule of origin, it will be complex, but it will be beneficial. The other thing in this free trade agreement package I want to mention is the TPP-11, Trans-Pacific Partnership. So once again, we managed to have a bipartisan endorsement in the parliament. So this agreement, if it go into force, out of these 11 countries, 98% of tariff will be eliminated. So it is great. And we need 6 countries to ratify in order to enforce. Now we had, I had Mexico, Japan, and Singapore, and Australia now already, the parliament already give green light, but they have to go the next level of legislation. So this is also important. And I mentioned just now my previous life in Austrade, based in China. So that was a time when Australia set up the free trade agreement with Northeast Asian countries, with Japan, South Korea, and China. All those are massive. All those managed to bring more prosperity, more job opportunity for Australia. So as far as the FIRB is concerned, the Foreign Investment Review Board, a lot of investors don't like FIRB because they feel FIRB just there to pick on look for fault. But I could tell you one of our senior executives was a former chair of FIRB. So FIRB work very efficiently and in a transparent way. We open for foreign investment, but you need to review case by case, and it is one-off decision. You won't have to go back and debate, and then it's a very lengthy process. So FIRB, once they decide case by case, it is final. And some of you might be aware, recently federal government also set up what we call CPC, Critical Infrastructure Center. So for important infrastructure facilities such as port, airport, railway, this is a central agency to collect all the advice, make sure that foreign investment is being appreciated, being reviewed carefully, fairly, and case by case. So this is something about FIRB. I wouldn't spend too much time what they say now. Just okay. So of course, national interest. It is always a balance. You have to protect national interest. And you might heard a lot of media talk about investors from countries like China or Asian country. They may think, you know, there's a few sensitive cases. But overall, our observation is FIRB has been working on a very balanced approach. So I just want to flick this very quickly. So there's a couple of notification requirements, and you could read it yourself. So if it is an acquisition larger than 20% or any investment that's done by foreign government. So a lot of Asian countries like Vietnam or China or Philippines, a lot of business are state-owned. So once you got state-owned, you have to go through FIRB regardless of the sum, the number of your investor, of your investment. And that is non-discriminatory with all countries. It is the same. So this page is just on foreign government. So foreign government, of course, they have to be ultra-cautious. And I can tell you, every government more or less the same standard, so we do it in a very transparent way. So I really don't see, we sometimes get compliant from business, but I think it is a fair process. Just very lastly, how Austrade can assist. So as a federal government agency, we don't focus on particular state jurisdiction, but we work very closely with state government, as you could imagine. Austrade focus is more pushing Australian companies to overseas market, and the state government, they more invest attraction. So if we have someone like from Serbia want to invest into Australia, we more or less will pass a case, share the case with state territory. Of course, we need to evaluate first where's the best place to locate, given local legislation preference or difference. So our focus is more when Australians want to go to overseas market. By the way, I forgot to mention just now in the FTA page, the top 20 foreign countries that Australian company have most interest to expand into, 18 out of that 20, Australia has an FTA there, free trade agreement, either bilateral or regional. So that's how we would like to help. Almost lastly, these are the sectors that we, as national priorities for foreign investment into Australia. And not surprisingly, you have service, and we talk about innovation just now. So all those key sectors are within our radar for foreign investment priorities. Is that all, May? Okay, so I wouldn't go into this too much. So we more or less as a government agency plays a role as a bridge between potential buyers and potential sellers, and between potential supply and potential demand. So if you would like to look into Australian market, look for some potential area, you don't know which state jurisdiction you should go, you could connect us and we could review the case with you, or when Australian companies are interested in going to Europe regions, which they do all the time, I might come to you and ask whether you're interested. So that's government platform. We do that kind of thing. This is every time when we talk to business, how you be successful in Australia, I talk about this thing. But don't you think wherever you go, these are important? It's more like you tell your children how to be a good human being. Just be sensible. You do your due diligence. But honestly, the last point, social license, that's really important. We come across a lot of foreign investors coming here. They're too much business-driven, and their connection or commitment with local community, local culture, local environment is limited. And when you have that attitude, it's really hard for you to go really further. So that's important. That's more the invisible soft power. You may not get much out immediately, but that's important. So this is, I think this is all I will cover. And once again, thank you for having me here, and look forward to the panel discussion and question time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shu Yang. That was a fascinating insight into what Australia can do. Certainly keep in mind any questions that come forward via our email addresses or phones. That said, our next presentation, we've got Ben Lanan from PwC. No successful company or deal is done without a successful advisor. So,
I thought you were going to say without me, but I'll take it.
Over to you.
Good evening, everybody. I had a conversation earlier with one of my colleagues, Melissa Camilleri, Nave Radisavić, who's of Serbian cultural heritage and a manager, trusted colleague in my team. And I said it would be great if I could have a few comments in Serbian as a mechanism to maybe connect. In my opening remarks, what I got was a kind of a giggle over the phone that sort of reflected more menace than anything else, and a suggestion that, geez, you must really trust me. Anyway, we ditched that idea, and I'm just going to settle with thank you for having me. And what I would like to say, and I've got a couple of comments around sort of what I wanted to talk about, but just sort of reflecting on the opportunity to speak tonight, and it's sort of born out of a number of conversations I had with Sasha and Goran over a period of time. One of the things that I was reflecting on, if you actually look at the at DFAT's resources, and they have a really good overview of Australian-Serbian relations, and one of the things that it points to, particularly given that trade between the two countries is starting from a small base, but recognising that it's growing, one of the things that it really emphasises in that is the importance of an existing sort of diaspora of Serbian people in Australia, a growing and interested and engaged business community. And I can certainly say in my role, so I'm a partner of PwC in our international trade and regulatory business, and I deal with a range of different business councils and business chambers, and I've never seen them more active because they all recognise the importance that local business chambers and the local business community aligned around trade with a particular sector mean for growth and trade of those two businesses. So I think what's happening is fantastic. And I think I'd like to think we'd all reflect on tonight as the beginning of something kind of really special in Australian trade. I also want to pick up on that as a theme in terms of beginnings because earlier in the evening I was met Gary, and we were talking about kind of 7-year cycles, and it was when I was thinking about, you know, how do I bring some of these themes together, kind of a snapshot of where trade is now, the role of services, and also importantly free trade agreements with the EU and that connection between Serbia and its acceptance into the EU. How do you bring that into a kind of a common thread? One of the things that I think was really important was to maybe actually look at things in terms of what does the world look like in 7 years' time. It had actually started off as a conversation really just about how the organisations we worked in sort of changed significantly over a period of 7 years, but kind of extrapolating that idea, let's take a leap forward into 7 years' time. And I think I certainly agree with Chu Yang's comments earlier that Australia is all about a rules-based, globalised economy, and that's not going to change. There is nothing that I've seen or heard from either of the major political parties that indicate that there is going to be any change in that. There's not going to be a retreat from globalisation. There's a clear common-sense recognition that a healthy, global, rules-based economy is good for Australia. So we leap forward 7 years' time. I think there's a few things that are likely. One, we'll have had at least 1 year, possibly five, absent Donald Trump's White House. I'm not going to make this political, and if there's anybody recording all of this, these comments are my own and not PwC's. But I will say that period of massive change and transition will be in the rear view, presumably. I expect we will see that Serbia will have effectively progressed into being a full member, or certainly participating in the fuller benefits of participation in the EU. And we will have a free trade agreement with the European Union. I also suspect, and we kind of have a look at the numbers, and a lot of the trade in goods in Australia, between Australia and Serbia at the moment, sort of focus on sort of certain types of capital equipment. But what I kind of experienced earlier on is anything to go by. We may see a sharp spike in the imports of Serbian Chardonnay. It may be driven by a partner in PwC Melbourne. But let's have a look at these numbers, because they do represent, I think, something quite a sharp differentiation. I haven't noted in those numbers, but of the non-EU participants in those CEE economies, Serbia stands out far and above in terms of its level of trade with Australia. I think the others are kind of double-digit millions in terms of bilateral trade to and from. And I think, with the exception of Albania, represent a comparative minority of that trade is actually in services. So what we're seeing with Serbia is a country that has already got, albeit, and I acknowledge the point around a relatively small base, and certainly when compared to countries like Poland and Czech Republic, you know, a reasonable but gap to close. Nevertheless, the beginnings of a pretty strong bilateral trade. And importantly, it's predicated on a focus on services. Ooh, mood lighting.
It's not time to go yet.
I thought I was getting the message, my time's up. But it is very much predicated on a focus on services. From an Australian perspective, playing to strengths of Australia more generally, but I would also add Victoria more specifically, around things like aged care and education opportunities, as well as tourism. And then obviously we've got a key strength for Serbia being a comparatively low cost but educated and skilled employment base, which enables and gives effect to things like business process outsourcing and IT services. So, you can see a picture there of a country that, while not a full participant of the EU, is nevertheless kind of showing some indicators of a mature trade relationship with Australia. Why do we care? Services and trade are overwhelmingly the fastest growing sector with all of our key trading partners. And there's obviously a focus there in Asia, but while still small, it is growing, and kind of, I think we're looking at probably sort of 25% is the target for Asia in about 4 or 5 years' time. Nevertheless, it reflects highest value add. It represents greatest opportunity for capital mobility, because we're talking about human capital, so much more portable in terms of the ability to deploy. And interestingly, we're going to see a contraction, or we're already seeing a contraction of value in terms of the, tangible goods. Things are becoming more commoditised. I'm not going to go into a whole bunch of sort of esoteric technology means economic theory around the impact of things like 3D printing, etc. But the focus on value add, and in particular services, is only going to, and particularly knowledge-based services, is only going to grow. So trade, small but growing, key message. It's a key feature of all of our new and any existing but currently reviewed free trade agreements. And I would note in particular the EU free trade agreement, and for that matter the British free trade agreements that are currently ramped up in importance as a number of countries kind of grapple with the impact of Brexit, changes to trading relationships with the US, and the importance of a plan B and a plan C, the desire to negotiate robust bilateral, and the ALP has a strong preference for multilateral free trade agreements, is only strengthening. And trade in services is very much at the pointy end of those discussions. We'll talk about the EU FTA in a moment, but services is clearly being recognised as an area where I think, kind of reflecting Chu Yang's earlier comment, you know, there's only so much left to do with goods, all right? Tariff rates are down. There are still some issues around geographic recognition for some goods, but it really does come down to how do we start to ease and uncomplicate, free up the trade in services and create preference for our preferred trading partners. I think I've already sort of touched on the key areas of opportunity. So the EU, before I sort of jump into that, I think it's probably worth noting, so PwC working with DFAT and, in fact, a number of your colleagues, Chiang, in Austrade, conducted a study, a fairly comprehensive study of free trade agreements. And I do want to emphasise their importance because, you know, through a combination of sort of focus group sessions, one-on-one interviews, an online survey, it was interesting. There was a number of messages. A lot of it is being, overwhelmingly, free trade agreements are good for trade, while a lot of businesses, about a third of them, would say that they're specifically contemplating free trade agreements as part of their trade strategy. And they may not necessarily be the singular driver of trading outcomes. They have certainly been influential in improving the outcomes of trade, and I don't think it's any great coincidence that our free trade agreements are, in fact, with our key trading partners. One obviously kind of influences the other, but there are clear benefits, but there's some challenges associated with free trade agreements. Larger businesses, we noticed, for example, were the primary beneficiaries able to access those. That reflected that small to mid-sized businesses were sort of less, I'll choose my words a bit more carefully, not so much less beneficial, but were less likely to access the full suite of benefits of free trade agreements. It's important to note that that DFAT and Austrade more broadly have taken really positive steps in terms of engaging with business to help them understand the availability of free trade agreements, how they apply and how they can be accessed. It's also important to note that notwithstanding the existence of free trade agreements, there do still remain some barriers to entry, particularly as it relates to services. I think the importance of mutual recognition around qualifications will continue to be a focus and is increasingly a something that is kind of getting into the nitty-gritty of free trade agreement negotiations. There's also an issue around mobility. So services are typically delivered either digitally or by people, and that requires, in a more global context, things like visas and cybersecurity rules and a whole range of other things that are maybe sort of indirect blockers but nevertheless reflect not just a focus on trade, but a lot of countries focus on border protection and security in a contemporary era. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. It's simply an interesting challenge for a lot of modern sovereign states to balance between their own border security needs and the free flow of capital and people for trade. Another point, and this kind of represents probably more my point of view, is that there is what we've also seen, and I think this does very acutely pick up on services in particular, and it kind of evolved in a discussion I was recently part of with the OECD around a particular study on some of the barriers associated with trade in services. We have been part of a global revolution in terms of multinational taxation, and the impact of that has been the refinement of a lot of international taxation rules and a significant tightening of rules around what constitutes a taxable presence, the basis upon which the activities of an organisation in one country delivering services either digitally or through participation on the ground constitutes a taxable presence in another location. Why do we care about that? Because businesses, particularly small, mid-sized businesses with a very specific offering seeking to reach out into the rest of the world and seeking clear mobility, are now faced with a significantly more complex tax regime that they have to navigate through. And I think we are yet to see, because these rules are relatively nascent, but I think we're yet to see the indirect impact of that additional administrative complexity on the free flow of services between jurisdictions. Might just spend a brief moment talking about, therefore, the EU FTA. And acknowledging that this is kind of an ongoing negotiation, I think it's probably worth spending a brief moment kind of thinking about where it's at. I think realistically, Serbia is not going to negotiate a free trade agreement with Australia anytime soon. So this will be the environment that trade and services by Serbia sort of migrates into. It's interesting, in terms of sort of bilateral trade, there are a range of different factors that are currently being negotiated around. I think financial services are a really key part of all of that, and the ability, particularly from what I've heard from a variety of different sort of public forums, the opportunity for European financial services to be able to participate in the Australian market, which is kind of pretty much dominated, certainly in the retail sector, around the sort of the big four. But balancing that, there's also, on the tangible goods side, a real sticking point around luxury car tax, and you can imagine the impact that that's having for exports of European vehicles. Rules of origin are also a common sticking point in Europe. Greek feta, French champagne, Spanish olives. These kind of jurisdictional issues that really sort of tie in tightly to the recognition of good and the desire to create some limitations around the naming conventions of particular products are an interesting one. And then sort of made a brief point there, sort of bridging communication barriers. In order to navigate through all of this, you'll be able to enshrine some of this in a free trade agreement, but there is always necessarily going to be collateral agreements, particularly as they relate to services, such as mutual recognition agreements, that are going to provide the basis through which the kind of practical day-to-day operation of some of these FTAs is delivered. And so from that perspective, there is going to be a need to kind of work through some of those arrangements as well. So I suppose from my perspective, they were kind of just some comments. I've kind of sort of whizzed through that on the basis that it would kind of leave about 5 minutes for questions, only to realise I think I've gone 5 minutes over and crept into Gary's time a bit. So happy to kind of hold off on the questions for now, unless there's anything sort of burningly urgent.
We can cover off as part of the panel as well.
Or we can cover it off in part of the panel. All right, sorry, Gary.
Thank you very much, Ben. That was great.
I love hearing all about the framework, but what I'm most pleased about is that you like the Chardonnay. I think that's great. We're running a special at the end of the night. you pay for three and you get six. No, I'm joking. I was actually, interesting story, I was recently at this particular winery we were on a trip in Serbia a couple of weeks ago, and they've got another five varieties. So if you're interested, we can always get Rust Trade. Is that right?
Yes, indeed.
The proud supplier of this particular variety. So the next presentation is the one that I'm really looking forward to hearing as well. And it's the one that's quite dear to me because Global IT Factory are one of our foundation members, and that is very, very special. And it's my pleasure to introduce Gary Foster, who is the founding director of Global IT. I won't steal your thunder, but I'll say a little bit about Global IT that I know, and that is that you're an Australian business set up relatively recently, and I know that you do some great stuff over in Serbia as well. But I'll leave it at that and let Gary talk to all the interesting bits. But over to you.
Thanks, Sasha. All right, so this is going to be quite different to the previous two speakers. I'm going to be talking about a business. So my name is Gary Foster. My business partner is Boris Rosenblatt, who is Serbian. We've both worked together for many decades in some pretty large corporates, and after about 30 years of doing that, we both got packages at the right time and said, let's do something different. So we've been in services, we've been in software development, we've been in research and development and a lot of stuff. Spending other people's money and making products for them, and we thought, yeah, we can do it differently. So Boris, who's actually just, well, in fact, we started this about 3 years ago, and I didn't realise that basically Boris would then spend every Australian winter in Serbia while I keep the business running here. And then he's basically coming on Friday because it's now getting too cold over there and summer's starting here. So I'm learning about the Serbian approach to business. But basically, our team is, majority of our team's in Serbia. And it's IT, it's services. And I'm going to just give a little bit of a flavour about outsourcing and offshoring, and then the flavour is with IT, outsourcing and offshoring, and then we'll get into just what we've done as a business in about 3 years, and we think we've kicked a lot of goals, and it's getting better and better. So with that, I'm going to basically cover it in three sections. So to get the language right to start with. Outsourcing and offshoring. So outsourcing is pretty simple. It's basically an organisation wishing to outsource or transfer part of their business. It can either be business process outsourcing, which can be everything from HR and business functions, or it can be IT outsourcing. Our part is IT outsourcing. And then the outsourcing component of it is basically it can be onshore or offshore. And we're doing a little bit of both. The majority of it's offshore, but you can't do everything offshore. You've got to have an onshore presence to manage and run the business. So why do people actually do outsourcing? I'm not sure if you can read the small font, but there's a number of reasons. The number one is cost cutting, but there's a lot of other reasons. And the little red ticks on the side are actually where we're getting business. So it's not out of cost cutting, right? We are actually cheaper. We were much cheaper, but the dollar's changed and wages are going up in Syria and things like that. But that's not where we're getting our business. Our business we're picking up is in the fact that we can enable businesses to focus on their core business. We're doing a lot of business with startups. And startups have got an idea. They need to focus on the idea. And even if the idea is software, their focus is on selling the idea, getting the investors, getting the blah, blah, blah. They don't want to be focusing on building the thing. So we're picking a lot of work up with this, enabling them to focus on core business, and the fact that they get access to an incredible technology base out of Serbia. I'll sort of touch on this a few times, but the biggest benefit we found out of Serbia is just the technical skill base, the engineering, the IT, a lot of double degrees, very strong, and of course the English helps as well. So that's why they outsource. The thing that's enabling offshoring for us is many things, telecoms, internet, etc. But the biggest one is cloud computing. We're doing a lot on cloud computing. So it doesn't matter where the IT is, we're able to access it. And we access it 24/7. There's now a lot of trust in cloud. If you're not familiar with cloud, it's basically these things sit in massive data centres. They appear like they're virtually there. They're not on your site. They're not behind your security system. So given the right authorization, we can get in. So we do a lot of cloud computing. We do a lot of work with Oracle. We've got some very strong relationships with Oracle. And we're able to basically work 24/7 on solutions around the world. All right, so let's just talk a little bit now about why Serbia, why outsource and offshore to Serbia. So the first thing is is the education, and I mentioned that before. Very highly skilled. Engineers are socially highly valued. The education system is strong. We've got this mathematics gymnasium in Serbia. My partner went through that. So we have a very strong technical skill base. So when we're considering things like, you know, Vietnam, Philippines, India, we're really, you know, I'm using the we, I'm not saying, but we are very highly competitive, very highly competitive. Some of the challenges, though, is that IT services and growth, this is not to Australia, the numbers aren't to Australia, they're sort of they're global, but they've been growing very rapidly. So we started off, in fact, apart myself in 2011, I joined a number of years later, and the amount of IT being explored is quite low. It's going up and up and up. It's great. But the corollary of all of that is the workforce availability is going down, 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 and wages are going up. So we're having to really balance. Now, because we're not in the business of trying to be the cheapest supplier, we're able to manage that quite significantly. But it is a challenge. It is a challenge. And, you know, we have to watch currency fluctuations quite closely. So just some of the strengths and weaknesses of IT outsourcing in Serbia. So the skill base, the resource base is great. The command of English is very good. A little bit later we'll talk about how we run some of our projects. In some cases we can set up a team in Australia working through Skype to the client. So there's no front end other than getting the engagement. And the language is sufficiently strong that they can do that. In other cases, it's not. The projects get bigger, you can't do that.
Somewhere over here.
The weaknesses, margins subject to exchange rates, bit of lack of referenceability. You know, Serbia's a small country. We've gone for some quite large deals. You don't really have the references yet to be able to pull in some of these. It's a relatively young workforce. The deals have been mid to small. The opportunities geographically. We've done a lot of work in Australia. Out of that work in Australia, we've actually got clients contacting us in Europe and the UK. And we're using the fact that we're going to say, well, we're Europe, so we're on your doorstep. So we can service Australia, but we can also service Europe and the UK. We make a lot of... we make use of the network, the expats, the relationships, contacts are everything. We're a small business, small to medium business, growing to medium business. Networking and connection is everything. The government investment IT is good. You know, they're really pumping up the IT opportunities in universities, in primary schools. But today, the demand is exceeding supply. There's a deficit of about 15,000 IT professionals in Serbia, and it's growing. And the people that are coming to the market, they're pretty young. And in, you know, classic, a bit like India. India went through this huge growth in IT. The really good people, you know, got gobbled up, disappeared, became super expensive. Then they brought in tons and tons of new people, and the new people are pretty average. What we're going to do is not become average. And at the moment, it's looking okay. But it's a challenge, it's a threat. All right, so we'll just talk about global IT. So our sort of business concept, our proposition is to use offshoring to Serbia, to leverage the lower cost, not low as it used to be, the skilled labour force, leverage our networks and successful IT entrepreneurship that we have with a range of people, leverage our business network in Australia. So myself, colleague Boris, we've got a very large network in Australia. So and that just came from our corporate, you know, 30 years working in companies like Fujitsu and Alcatel and various other big players. And to also leverage our IT service and development skills. So we both ran large software development groups, services groups, research and development groups, so we know what it is. And in fact, quite a number of the people that work with us have now worked with us 15, 10, 15 years ago in those corporates. And they've moved on and we've re-established connections. So we've used that. We have a service delivery model that basically sometimes has an onshore team, and when I'll talk through the projects, the big projects have onshore teams. But we have a GITF Europe, a Global IT Factory Europe, based in Belgrade, where we have permanence, and we try to leverage that and use that and keep the work coming in to keep those permanents, because that's the cheapest, most effective way to deliver services. But we augment that through delivery partners. So we've had things where things just come out of nowhere. You're asked to deliver in months, and you need to tap in. So there are a lot of delivery partners that we've basically done pre-agreed business arrangements. So we've got transfer pricing, we've got their rate sheets, etc. So we can go in very quickly and price a job. And so our first is to use our own team. Our second is to use our partners. And then if that doesn't work, then we'll bring in supplementary resources contracting. So, as a small to medium business, we've got to manage cash flow and scale. And we've had things where we've had to scale very quickly, but you've got to drop as quick as you grow. So once the work gets near completion, you just can't be handing on to the resources. You just can't do it. So we've used this technique to grow and shrink effectively on demand. So our main centre is in Belgrave. We've got people like Exicom in Novostat who are doing work for us now, and we've built a few relationships with sort of smaller companies in niche that we've been involved in bits. We're trying to secure business, but we've basically gone through a thing of pre-vetting where their skills are, what technologies can they work with, what projects can they use as references. I mean, when you go into a contract, you've got to have references. You've got to be able to demonstrate how you've worked in this. So we've been doing that sort of pre-vetting, and we can bring it into bids quite quickly. That's our team. So it's a mixture of onshore, offshore. If you can pick Serbian faces, then they're probably offshore. It's a pretty diverse team. So I'll just now go through a few real projects, just to tell you what we've really been doing, give you a bit of scale and size of some of the activities. So this one, few too many words, but it's higher education. So we've landed a deal, we're about to complete it with the Australian National University in Canberra. We're building a platform to manage their entire curriculum, that's their degrees, courses, subjects, offerings. We landed the deal, they went to the market and looked for all the existing products and vendors, couldn't find one. Through our relationships with Oracle, Oracle brought us in, said these guys can build you a solution, and they said, yep, that's great, we'll pay you for it, and we'll give you the IP, because then you can go and sell it elsewhere, and then we'll get the benefit, because you'll have a product that you're selling around the world. We said, great, we'll have that, thank you very much. So we're about to complete that in a matter of weeks. We've got the Serbian ambassador coming into the uni in Canberra to meet with the execs. There's a bit of a celebratory, they're really happy with it. They are our main sales force. The Australian National University is selling actively in university conferences the product that we've built. We got contacted last week by Cambridge University in the UK to look at this product. So it's gone international. So brilliant. And completely built in the cloud in Serbia. So in Australia, I served as one of the business analysts, so we specified it. We talked to the unis every day. Basically, we built it offshore. So that's been a fantastic experience. We've done a lot of work with fintechs, so financial technology companies. This one is Moneysoft. We did their mobile apps. This particular company, again, they were looking to focus on the core business, which was going into the financial sector, talking to the companies that were going to buy this, the banks and the financial services organisations. And we built their mobile platform. They've, as a startup, have just been going up and up, and it's great. When you back a startup that's actually in huge growth mode, you couldn't be in a better position because they drag you up with them. We've been pretty lucky. I don't think we've really backed any startups that have gone down. They've hovered and stayed, but they haven't crashed. This particular one is really good, and the business model that if they give us referrals, we'll give them credits for business. So we'll do more services work if they give us a referral. So these crowds are actually actively talking to their other startup businesses that they know their network, and they're bringing us sales opportunities. So we don't have a sales force. We rely on referrals. And it's the most effective because they immediately, how were they? We've been using Global IT for a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years. It's been great. It's the best reference you can have. And a lot more cost effective. We're doing things with Queensland Railways. So we're building that thing you see in the picture there is a completely brand new type of level crossing. So out of work in Serbia, we're about to change the landscape of rural and regional Australia for fully automated level crossing technology that's to pull down the road toll. So basically we're after high-risk accident spots. Current technologies are far too expensive. We've come up with a system that's solar-powered, it's autonomous, it's got smarts, radios, etc. And we're basically kind of selling that into Queensland. And then so this work, this isn't our product. We've worked for a startup that's built the product, but we're the technology arm of that startup. Okay, and the relationship is so good that startup's offering us shares in their company because they want to keep us. They don't want us to disappear. So, again, a fantastic reference. So this one is electronics, it's hardware, it's software, it's a whole lot of stuff. It's safety, it's pretty high-tech engineering. And then we've got a number of others. So InvestFit, this is a financial planning. Again, this is another mobile app, web app service, where they're basically looking to bring a solution so that you can consolidate all of your accounts and then make some really smart recommendations about where you could be investing. Now, what InvestFit have built is some incredibly good algorithms for trying to tell their clients where to put their money. The smarts is in the algorithms. We've come along to provide the IT software and platform to put those algorithms into use. So we haven't built the algorithms. They've got the intellectual property. We're just making it real and enabling it. A company called Blue Chili, this is what we call a startup incubator. This company, owned by Myers family, quite a few big players in this, basically they bring in dozens and dozens of startups or entrepreneurs who want to be startups, pre-vet them, and if they're good, they give them coaching, they give them a bit of cash, and of course what they're trying to be is they're trying to get the 1 in 100 that goes from $100,000 company to $10 million. That's what they want to be in, because then they'll get a share owning and they'll get their money back. So these guys play the big game. And we provide the software that they then give to each startup to help them run their business. It's been a long-term relationship. And we're even in various government panels. We've been pre-selected and preferred suppliers now for all sorts of IT services with the Victorian government. So I'll stop on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary. That really does bring it to life, and I think what it does also do is sends a very powerful signal to local companies that things like this can be done, and fantastic case study. And I will point out that you're part of that stack probably, the export stack.
Yeah. Solid percentages.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating numbers. I think you had a figure of roughly about 800 million euros of exports of services from Serbia. So the likes of Microsoft, NCR, and obviously Global IT Factory are part of that stat, but I'm sure you work your way up there sooner rather than later. So it's a really great speech, but we're over to the panel now. I think it's an opportunity for everyone to get engaged and ask questions. I think we've heard a lot from Gary, Ben and Chuyang respectively. For me, there's some really powerful takeaways. I think, Chuyang, I'll just quickly reflect on your speech, and that was very much about what Austrade can do, but also there was a message there around, now's the time. It's an emerging country, and as it prospers, it will eventually require more services and will export more services as well. So that's a great opportunity for companies that are considering these types of things to activate now. I think with Ben, the framework, really great to know what we're up against now and in the future and what to expect and what not to expect as well. But I think one key message that I'll probably take away from your speech was that we've got an optimal framework outside of the EU to play,
and leading into EU, it's likely to get better. Serbia is very much focused on the EU when it comes to trade. I think, you know, we distributed some pamphlets that something like 60% of the trade is with the EU, or probably more when you add Switzerland and Norway and other countries that are sort of on the peripheral. But it is looking out to other nations as well. So China's been quite active. I know, Chuyang, you spent some time in China. They've done some incredible projects recently that I've certainly heard about. I can't testify, you know. That will evolve over the next few years. But we're looking forward to, you know, having the Australian firms as well partake in that, where traditionally we know that trade's been very geared towards Asia. So trying to stay relevant is one of our key challenges. That said, I'll hand over to Aaron, who will moderate the panel, and looking forward to everyone just asking a few questions, or two or three.
Right, Chair and Ben and Gary, look, that was excellent talks, and look, I actually feel a little bit relieved, because I wanted to keep my contribution very, very short and sweet, and you have basically been able to touch on all the key points that I thought were really relevant in relation to the services trade possibilities. So, you know, the areas of outsourcing and professional services, education and tourism, the investment aspects, and the importance of services trade between the countries, and of course the resource and location advantages that Serbia provides for Australian businesses, but as well creating a possibility for mutual benefit to be exploited. Now, I have prepared a few questions to the panel so that we can tease out some of the key and interesting pieces of information, but I also do realize that we are in a bit of a time juggling situation. So I would like to put forward to the audience whether they wish to proceed with the questions that I have prepared to our panel, or whether they wish to contribute their own questions and listen to those getting answered.
I think there's one question over there from the back row.
I'm not sure. There'll be a few hands going up to say that, yes, we want to ask questions. So I can ask a question?
Please go ahead.
Okay. So, thanks very much, guys. All very interesting presentations. I was particularly interested in Gary's presentation because I have an engineering and IT background, and I love what you've been able to do with the Serbian market. My question relates to some of the products that you've developed, obviously very, very valuable for the Australian market. Are you selling a lot of the products to other countries outside of Australia? That's question number one. Question number two, have you had any luck in convincing the local, government and entities to look into purchasing some of these services? Because some of the stuff that you've developed is very much needed in the whole Western Balkans region, in particular the IoT solution with railway crossings and so on. I think that's brilliant. And what sort of barriers are you seeing in selling those services, even at a discounted rate, for the local government as opposed to, you know, the top rates that you're getting in Australia?
Okay, so a few things there. We haven't looked locally being Serbia, I assume you mean local. So we haven't looked. With all of these things, it's bringing the product to market is the first thing. The education one, the curriculum management, which is for higher education, is probably the peak one. We've actually presented that in the US and to Berkeley, and we've now got hooks coming in from the UK, so we think that's the most likely one that's got the most growth potential. The railway technology one, we've actually been contacted by Canada, and basically anywhere that's got very long train lines with lots of rural and remote this is where it fits. So we've been contacted by them, so we're getting basically, without marketing, they're just becoming aware of us through trade shows, through various other things that we've presented at, or Queensland Rail or other operators have presented at. So the answer is no, not at the moment, and probably because we've just been too busy developing these things and trying to get them up to a thing where they can then, you know, live their own lives, and then we can invest. So no, not at the moment.
If I might just follow it up with one comment or a question. I think there's an imminent need for a lot of these services that are being outsourced. Amazing things are being developed in that whole Western Balkan region and are being outsourced to the rest of the world. We're basically developing tech for the world. Not a lot of that technology is actually being adopted within the country itself. It probably needs it more than anyone else. So I'll be very keen to see how you know, some of this technology could be adopted, or at least placed in front of the decision makers.
So it would be incredibly desirable, because one of the things that we're trying to achieve, especially with the education one, if you could get into a university in Serbia, is once you get your second, third, fourth reference site, you soon become incredibly credible. You need a certain scale to then become taken up globally. And we're right at that point now where we're trying to get our second, third, fourth site. So if there's a method to do that, then we're very open with ANU in Canberra. They're aware that this is all fully developed in Serbia. Very, very open. We've got to the point now that they directly talk every day with the Serbian team. They love them. They're about to try and get us another years of pretty major enhancements to this product and continue to fund it and source it. And so it's a brilliant situation at the moment. But to leverage it even more by taking it to Serbia would be just brilliant. If you know somebody, please tell us.
That's what we're here for,
actually. The network effects.
That's right.
Look, thank you very much for that, and I think that was very specific questions aimed at one of our panel members, and I'd like to continue with something that perhaps all of our panel members can share their thoughts on. So just to keep it very sharp and sweet, the first question I have to the panel, and I'd like you to take some time to consider and perhaps give me your best one-sentence shot at an answer to see where you're standing with these. The first question is, in your view, what is the top biggest business opportunity in the service sector between Australia and Serbia? So what's your top? And I think I know what Gary's going to say, but
making me feel nervous, like in the interview.
Yeah.
Oh, no pressure.
Okay. I'll leave Gary to discuss his point of view, but if I think about maybe from an outbound Aussie perspective, I think there's some really interesting things happening in the education sector at the moment, specifically as it relates to sort of skills-based training. There's been a significant, you almost call it preoccupation, with China and parts of Asia, and that's starting to change. China's actually got a dedicated policy around becoming a net exporter of education services. So interestingly, I think we're not going to completely displace Asia Pacific. No, it'll always be a key market for education services. But I do think, particularly with a free trade agreement, that the opportunity to export, specific skills based programs efficiently into Central and Eastern Europe and Serbia in particular is a real opportunity. I think that was slightly longer than a sentence, but yeah.
I just follow what I my presentation. When people get to the middle class, more money, they demand a whole suite of services, and in combination with Australians. Very strong industry in, say, health supplement, in wealth management. If we see companies like Blackmore, like Swiss go everywhere, why shouldn't they go this part of the world? So people need more nutrition and a better, healthier lifestyle. So, and also demographically, every country is facing an aging problem. That's no, some country get both rich and old. Some country get old first before they get rich. Maybe that's a difference. But every country, aged care is inevitable, a challenge. So aged care related, I agree with Ben on the training of workforce, on the products,
yep.
On how to operate and manage the facility, the whole suite. So it yes. will be a long list. I'm reluctant to say which one comes number one. I don't know this part of Europe very well, but just from a more generic point of view, the whole suite of service will be relevant. Maybe a different weight, but it will be relevant.
Yes. Thank you.
Mm. IT.
Are you sure? You know what I would expect from an IT engineer. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. Insightful. So we've covered the spectrum there. The next question I have to the panel is, so what are your expectations regarding the impact of the Serbia's European Union integration and the development of the EU-Australia Free Trade Agreement on these opportunities?
You ask hard questions. Well, I just make a start on this one because Australia and the DFAT, we have a committee on these FTAs. But other than the Asian part of the FTA, the European Union is a number one, the most important one for Australia itself, already show how critical we take this market as. I think it is a complex time. So with what happened with the Brits, what happened with them, so Britain now has to get a status to become an independent negotiator with the rest of the world, because before it is part of the European Union, and there will be a lot of changes between European Union and the WTO as well. So I think Serbia comes in at a very interesting time, hopefully be a good beneficiary. It will be challenging as well. So Australians put a lot of emphasis. I mean, we're not doing this just for show. We really want to tackle some of the non-tariff barriers between European Union and Australia. So it is the timing really can't be better. It will take a few years for this to really take shape. So as I mentioned, we started June this year to kick off. I would say service will be a very big focus during this FTA, and also the standardization of a lot of technical standard. It is all service-related thing, and also on how to settle dispute, how to do trade facilitation. So anyway, I don't have a concrete answer, but I'm positive it is a great timing now to get some really solid outcome for business.
Terrific, thank you.
You go ahead. No. I'm not sure what to add to that.
I'm not sure I could add to that. I mean, the only area that we would see some benefit is in the IT space, is a thing called data sovereignty and privacy and security. And depending on where we are, because there's this lack of trust where data is housed, so if the European Trade Agreement got us, that it would make it easier to move.
Specific governance and trade.
Exactly right.
And that kind of counts for the education sector.
Yeah,
as well.
Absolutely.
We're looking for a university. We're dreaming about those days when mutual recognition of qualifications becomes part of a trade agreement.
That's right.
And therefore, we're going to be in an even better place.
Yep.
To export our services.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. The only comment I might sort of add on top of that, I mean, kind of moving past maybe some of the uncertainty that's created through the transition, and particularly how Serbia sort of fares in terms of what access to that single market means in terms of labour mobility, single currency conversion, all of those sorts of things. And I think, to your point, I think the labour mobility piece will be an interesting one. You mentioned the challenge around retaining talent now. The reality is if I look at what Australia has to offer and that focus on services and the opportunity for Serbia logically to, over the medium to long term, prosper, improved incomes, additional savings, etc., means you're going to start accessing the sorts of services that Australia likes to provide, so the experience-based services, so travel, education, etc. So I see that as a long-term an opportunity for Australia. And I've already seen
through some of my own clients, the sort of the proliferation of Serbia and sort of Central Eastern Europe more generally as a increasingly preferred centre for business process outsourcing. Particularly, everyone talks about the tyranny of distance, but it has the advantage of actually being in the other time zone. So businesses that are looking to kind of run a 24/7 model, it's emerging there. So I can see greater connection in that service front as confidence builds.
So my last question, I really thought that the questions would feel simple, so let me have a third go at it and you let me know if they
it's
became...
It's entirely possible I'm overthinking it.
Okay, so what would be your one recommendation for someone who would like, let's say, an Australian entrepreneur who would like to exploit opportunities between Australia and Serbia in the services sector?
I might have a go at doing... Chu Yang's answer, which would be talk Australia.
No, I said talk was bad.
And so this is, why don't we all agree that we're... No, I think... So talking to my clients who've looked at this sort of thing, I think there is... and I've now understood the incredible wisdom of Goran and Sasha's panel. I think you do need to access the support that Austrade provides, but you're going to... If you're going to go deep, you are going to need additional support. And that does come from advisors, but I think it also comes from talking to people in the business community who've been there and done it before, people like Gary. There's a lot to be gained from that kind of collective experience in terms of what is the regulatory framework, what is the institutional support, and what is the real-life experience.
Yeah, I don't think you can add much to that. I think if you're going to do it, so, I mean, we've spent some time, Boris being over there now, we go and further pre-vet partners, and you can only do that face-to-face, no matter what Austrade support you've got. You've got to go and talk, and you need to test them on bids, and that's the only way you're going to sort out the ones that are going to work.
Look, I'm not going to sell Austrade. I'll tell you how, what's Austrade value in any overseas market. When you want to deal with government, especially when you start, I'm not quite sure about the Serbian culture, but the Asian culture, very government dominating. So if you go to Korea, you go to Japan, you go to China, government actually part of the business life. They're not to say helping or facilitating, they just the main player. So when you just started, you need to someone to hold your hand to introduce you to the local mayor, to the local authority. That's how Austrade can help. Right. But we don't have that much business sense as the Garys would provide. I would say, regardless of from Australian go to Serbia or from Queensland go to WA, as long as you change jurisdiction, you need to get good suggestion, referral, or good story or horror story from the business like Gary. So it is talking among business. That's why events like today, you may not get something immediately out of it, but it is important. You get other people's story. So we help you to navigate the government side, which is not important, but that's only one portion. And sometimes, if in a culture which government is basically, you know, keep out of business, it is not as critical as in other market. So I would say talking with other business, similar business, get good reference will be very important.
Thank you very much. And I wholeheartedly agree with what's been said here. Having a few years of doing the Central European Business Forum, what came through in our repeated discussions was that person-to-person connections, tangible physical experience, and actually going into the market and reaching out to the right sources to facilitate the appropriate level of networking that is needed for your business success is really, really the essential way to tackle the potentially unfamiliar foreign market. So,
I think one of the observations, and this has actually been borne out by some of our colleagues from Austrade and DFAT, and Gary, be interested in your thoughts as well. But you kind of got to be committed for the long haul. You know, it's not a question of maybe joining an Austrade delegation, having a look around, expecting, you know, supply contracts to come falling out of the sky into your lap. There is it just doesn't happen. It's not that easy. There needs to be a real connection buttressed by a real business opportunity that you're prepared to work towards over a period of time, as opposed to sort of opportunistic sort of go in and make a quick grab for business, because that will generally disappoint.
If that did actually exist, everyone would be doing it.
Yeah.
It just doesn't. It's not reality.
Yeah.
Well, those were my three questions for a panel conversation, and if we have inspired some more questions from the audience, we'd welcome to hear them, please.
Hi, just a question for Chiang and Ben. You both made note to products and services being sold. However, there are third types of revenues, being intellectual property or licensed revenue structures that even my company is looking at. How is the Australian government looking at maintaining a competitive field compared to, say, Singapore, who you have on your chart, who can, in certain circumstances, tax IP at 10%? So how are some ways that you see in industry through your creative accounting?
I don't know what you're talking about. I think you're referring to patent box arrangements, yeah.
So, obviously, to be more competitive and keep the IP here, Australia does need to address this issue. So, is there anything that you're currently working on or anything of that note to in discussion? Because it's great having free trade agreements, but when the dollar lands here, we're still taxed normally for it.
Yeah. I'm happy to have a kind of a first crack at some of the incentive regime, and it's kind of preface everything I say with, you know, I'm not an incentives expert, but I've kind of dabbled in value chain transformation that does look at the desirability of different locations as a kind of a principle or hub for international business. So there is a highly differentiated set of regimes around how you incentivise the attraction of IP-based investment, the development of IP. I mean, Singapore has an entire arm of its government, the Economic Development Board. I've dealt with them. They're probably amongst the most sophisticated public servants I've ever come across, incredibly commercial and entirely empowered to present a range of incentives. So concessional tax rates for income earned on the exploitation of IP from Singapore is an example, but also, you know, some pretty heavy cost subsidisation for R&D centres, tech centres in Singapore. Probably worth noting, but that has been enormously successful but attracted the ire of a range of international tax authorities, because they're typically tax-based incentives, in the same way that the UK patent box regime, which taxes at 10% international income from IP-based stuff, and I think Italy's doing one as well. And there's even talk being presented to the Australian government around, should we have this sort of regime as well? Australia deals with it differently. There are a variety of kind of state-based investments, although they typically focus on manufacturing with a skew towards tech-based manufacturing. And there are R&D concessions, and there's been some recent changes to our R&D concessions that are much more skewed towards more genuine innovation, and particular startup-type innovation. But it's a complicated process, and it's typically kind of now ring-fenced by a certain pool of funds that have to be distributed. So the more innovation you have, the, you know, smaller piece of the fund you get back. You're talking, but so that's kind of an idea of what exists and where. Ultimately, you're talking about revenue and tax-based policy, and that's a pretty interesting conversation to have with the Australian government at the moment, which is kind of looking at how does it kind of retain good ideas and retain people, while at the same time kind of honouring a pretty strong stance it's taken around international taxation, and keeping and balancing the books, and not sort of giving revenue away to multinational businesses, etc. So it's a very nuanced issue. I'm not saying anything's one way, right or wrong, one way or the other. But Australia's just simply not going down that path, at least in the from what I'm seeing.
I keep looking at it. I didn't realise Serbia has such a good Chardonnay, so I just keep... I just add very briefly. It's harder to take one parameter out and compare. There's a lot of debates and criticism within government on Australia's taxation system and how we hold the revenue. Very complex. I don't have enough technical knowledge to make remark on that. But any country's competitive advantage coming as a package, it's not just to say take out taxation or take out one thing. And Australian as a country is a benchmark for OECD countries in many aspects because of our legislation, because of transparency and rule-based. It's easy to say, but it's not easy to implement. Mm-hmm. But all those are attractions. But we have a lot of room that we need to amend and make progression. I'll just give you an example. As far as Ben mentioned about aged care just now, so Australia was the first country in the world, I'm talking about advanced economy, had a minister for aged care, and we had 80 years legislation. It's a very advanced package of legislation. So when I was working in Asian countries, we draw heavily the reference from Australia. They're not necessarily cheap. It got a lot of room for being better. But the whole package, what I'm saying is attraction comes from the whole package. It's not one or two factors that you can single out and say, why are we not as good as Singapore or other country? Of course, we should get better. But from government point of view, the other thing I can tell you as Australian, I call it shortcoming, is we're very good at innovation, but Australia is not good at commercialization. So a lot of time, the idea stay in laboratory, and it just doesn't generate into a commercial outcome. So that's something we need to learn from the Israel, from Sweden, from other countries. So it all coming as a package. I must have to stop.
Alright, so ladies and gentlemen and the panel, let's put our hands together for our panel. Thank you very much. Over a couple of drinks now, you can ask more questions.
So I just got to say a few words to close it off. Thank you for being here tonight. So fascinating panel discussion, and there'll be more time to hopefully the panel speakers. Presenters will hang around for a few more questions during the networking session. So from my perspective, excellent program. I've really enjoyed it. I hope you did as well. Chardonnay is getting a really good rap, so I think we should move over here very, very quickly before it disappears. And having said that, putting a night like this together is almost next to impossible without sponsors and partners. So very special thank you to our platinum sponsor, Global IT Factory, and the catering is tonight courtesy of Global IT and Rastrade, who supplied some of the alcoholic beverages. Also, very special thank you to Ben and Chiu Lang for excellent presentation, setting the framework, introducing Austrade, PwC respectively, and setting the scene and the framework in which we operate. In addition to that, ICH is a huge supporter of these sorts of initiatives. Margaret, I thought you went home, but you're here.
Yeah,
so. It's great to see that you're still around. So, thanks again for your support and the support the ICH provides. SBS Radio, who's been following us, over there in the background, but they've been a kind supporter even before we started this story. And I think I haven't forgotten anyone, but this man over here, Goran, he's put in an enormous effort to put this together. And
I'm good.
So he's put in an enormous effort to put this together. So thank you very much. I really, really appreciate it, and I hope others do as well. That formalises the formal part of the proceedings tonight. And thank you once again. And please enjoy the drinks and refreshments.